Welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about the Viking sagas. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Arthur Herman, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, whose many books include How the Scots Invented the Modern World and Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II. His latest, just out, is The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. He podcasted with us previously on The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius. That was episode number 63 in this series. He joins us by phone as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Arthur, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to come and talk about somebody else's book in addition to my own.
So why are the Viking sagas or the Norse sagas or whatever we want to call them, why are they great books?
They're great books, I think, for one very simple reason, and that is that they have had a sweeping influence on the way in which romantic and fantasy literature has been shaped and plots taken and characters and even characters' names borrowed, really from the sort of mid-19th century on, really up to where we are with the J.R. Tolkien Lord of the Rings cycle, with the operas of Richard Wagner, even Star Wars, the Marvel comic heroes, all contain reverberations of the themes as well as characters and the plot lines that you find in the Norse sagas. It's an extraordinary cultural legacy. But there's another reason, too. It's not just the influence, John. It's also because they're so highly readable, and probably the most readable of all the literature that's been handed down to us from the European Middle Ages. And that makes them, I think, very approachable, and it makes a lot of people who are writers themselves who have read them to say, you know what? I can tell a story like that. I can do it in a simple and straightforward one, which is full of action and full of events, but also reveals something about human character and about the qualities that go into to making us fully human in a world which sometimes demands the opposite side of our personalities, the violent, the confrontational, the hard, dark edge that events and our conflicts with others sometimes call upon.
We're going to talk about all of that, the people and the culture behind these Viking sagas. We're going to discuss a couple of the most important and influential stories, the amazing explorations of the Vikings, including their arrival in North America before Columbus, and what the sagas say about them. Arthur, let's start with just a little bit of context. Remind us, who were the Vikings and what's a saga?
Well, the Vikings, number one, kind of are the members of the Scandinavian tribes who descended on a virtually defenseless Dark Age Europe, starting at the end of the 8th century in the 790s. The first great raid, Viking raid on the monastery at Lindisfarne on the English coast in 795. That usually is seen as the start of the Viking Age. And for the next 200 years, these boatloads of Danish, Swedish, and Norwegian young men and young women, as we've also come to discover, as I explained in Viking Heart, the archaeology and DNA has revealed a lot about just how, in some cases, unisex these Viking raiding parties really were. But the raids that they conducted and the loot that they brought back not only transformed life for Scandinavia, giving Scandinavians in a very harsh and inhospitable climate with very limited resources, including very little land for cultivation, brought back the commodities and the manufactured goods from the superior societies and around them, but it also transformed Europe at the same time, because where the Vikings went and where they settled became part of the remaking of the landscape of the Middle Ages. and the rulers who emerged from the end of the Viking Age, men like William the Conqueror, for example, men like Count Roger d'Hauteville in Sicily, were what established the new frontiers for Western Christendom and really take Europe in a totally different direction after that. The book Viking Heart, my new one, goes into some detail about the ways in which the Vikings went from being pillagers, which is the way we think about them, right, from the TV shows and popular images of them, you know, Hagar the Horrible, that comic strip that ran for years and years, the transition from raiders to traders, and then to settlers and eventually rulers in large parts of Europe, including medieval Russia.
We do think of them as book burners, destroyers of manuscripts and literature. But they did have their own literature, and these are the sagas. What are the sagas? What is a saga?
The saga is simply an epic poem. That's basically what it is. And the Vikings themselves were the progenitors of these stories, these epic tales, which they passed down as a part of oral tradition. And this is the case with all of these great epic poems from Indo-European peoples as they spread out across Europe and into Central Asia. It's true for the Homeric poems of the Greeks. It's true for the Mahabharata in India and the Aryan rulers there. And it's also true for the Norse sagas. These were recited poems by poets, by bards who would sing the exploits and the tales of gods and warriors in the evenings to the rulers and aristocrats and chieftains of the local tribes. What makes the sagas then into literature, John, is that about 200 years after the heyday of the Vikings, a number of these poets, skaldas is the Norse word for them, began writing these down. The Scandinavian populations began to adopt the Latin alphabet as they converted to Christianity. They began to take on the Latin alphabet, and so they began to transcribe what was oral poetry, right, memorized and passed down generation to generation. They began to write these down in their own language, in Old Norse, not in Latin, which makes a big difference, by the way, but in the vernacular. And it's those written sagas that are written down about 200 years after the Viking Age, starting in the 13th century, 1200s, in Iceland, which is the main center for this writing of saga literature. And then for the next 200 years, they continued this kind of work as the number of tales and stories and epics, both long and short, become transcribed onto vellum parchment and have been passed down to us since.
One of the best known of these sagas is called Njál's Saga. That's spelled N-J-A-L, Njál's Saga. If I had to sum it up in a sentence, I would say it's a family feud. It's the Hatfields and McCoys in Iceland. Is that true? And how would you describe it, Arthur?
Well, you know, if you look at a lot of these epic poems, right, a lot of them are about families and clans fighting among each other. That's true for Greek myth and for the Greek epics as well. You know, as they say, right, everything you want, if you want to write a short story, you want to write a novel, write a screenplay, the driving force behind it, the narrative has to be conflict. Well, there's plenty of conflict in the Viking world, and it's reflected in the epics that they recited and then wrote down, and therefore this is the warp and woof of your Norse sagas. Is describing these kinds of family feuds. But it's more than, in the case of Njál's Saga in particular, it's more than just a record or a recitation of, you know, how members of one great house sought out and killed others and then were sought out themselves to be killed in revenge. It's also about the other key element, I think, that makes for first-rate novels, for first-rate literature, and that is, it's also about the arc of the characters. And this is typical of so many of the Norse sagas, is that we see our main characters, in this case, the characters of Njal, for whom the saga is named, and then also Gunnar, who is his friend, who is a distinguished warrior, but at the same time is a warrior who doesn't like fighting. Not your typical Viking stereotype, that's for sure. But who understands the human cost of the lives that are taken and of the conflicts that arise as a result of this long-standing feud. And so what we see, the arc of the story is, if you like, the character development. Characters who find themselves thrust into this atmosphere of hostility, of rivalry, of family feud, along Hatfield-McCoy lines, there's no doubt about that. It's an excellent parallel. But who, in the process, come to understand more about themselves and whose relationships with others are changing as a result of the conflicts that take place. And the choices that they make. This is the other thing about the Norse sagas that's so interesting, including Njal's saga, is that of people who make bad choices in marriage, bad choices in choosing sides in political conflicts or in dynastic rivalries, and have to adjust to and live with the consequences of those choices. I think there's one of the things that makes them stand out from other types of medieval literature that's been handed down to us is that we see human beings in 3D. We come to understand their thinking. We understand the psychology that makes them, that motivates them to do the kinds of things that they do. And we can see them living, in many cases, with regret for the types of decisions that they've made and having to face up the responsibility of having done that. And Njal and Gunnar are very good examples of that as the story proceeds. And I won't try to summarize the epic. It's a series of incidents. But also, the other thing about the epics, too, that mention, and Njal's saga is a great example, is they also give us a really vivid picture of what life is like in the Viking Age, looking back, what marriage is like, about how husbands and wives choose each other. And don't think for a minute this is an entirely patriarchal, dominated society. In Viking society, as I explained in Viking Heart, there was a lot of respect for women. Women had, for the time and for the age, had some very unique rights, including with regard to marriage and divorce, and those are reflected in the Norse sagas as well, including Njal's saga. The other thing that I really like about Njal's saga, why it's such a great picture of what life is like for Viking families, and Viking warriors and heroes, is a lot of the action takes place around the tribal assembly, the thing, which is the Vikings' primitive version of democracy, a sort of big gathering place where all the members of the tribe and the elders and the chieftains and sub-chieftains all come to draw together their followers and to grapple with politics and the political infighting, but which is also a place in which you see other kinds of conflicts between characters, between families, being played out on the sidelines. So it's a really vivid picture of what life is like in a typical Viking setting. Very different from the stereotype picture that we have of these people who, spend all their time either sailing off on pillaging expeditions or feasting. That's the other thing the movies always portray, is everybody's feasting all the time. If you're a Viking, my God, how many drunken feasts can you stand at one time? These are reminders that these are real people, not comic book or TV heroes.
Another well-known saga is Egil's saga. That's E-G-I-L. Tell us quickly, what is Egil's saga? And be sure to mention my favorite Viking character in all of Viking literature, Erik Bloodaxe.
Erik Bloodaxe, what a name. Yeah, it's the story of Egil's saga is, again, it's a family saga. It's the story of the initial character's beginnings. His name is Thorolf, and his sons and grandsons, and among them is the central character for the whole poem, who is Egil. And Egil is from the moment of birth, he's a troublemaker. The saga tells us that at 3 years old, he's as big and tough as a 6 or 7 year old, is, and he's constantly getting into fights and scrapes. So it's only natural that he becomes not only a Viking pirate, setting off on marauding expeditions, in order to increase his honor and to increase his loot, but he also becomes a mercenary captain. And he quarrels with his king, the king of the Norwegian king, to whom he's supposed to owe obedience and fealty, who goes by the name of Eric Bloodaxe. Those names, by the way, for those Viking kings, Eric Bloodaxe, Harold Bluetooth.
These sound like characters from Dungeons and Dragons.
That's right, Harold Greycloak. That really does sound like a character from a Tolkien, doesn't it? From Lord of the Rings. These sobriquets are probably not ones that the kings themselves or chieftains had. You know, they didn't introduce themselves, "Hi, I'm Eric Bloodaxe." What more likely, these are simply sobriquets that are given to them by the poets, by the skaldas, in the course of writing these or reciting these epics. You know, it's like the way we would talk about, you know, Ronald Reagan as the great communicator, right? But it only summarizes one aspect of his personality or of his presidency or what he was like as president, or Hubert Humphrey as the happy warrior. You know, those are those kinds of names. And in the case of Eric Bloodaxe, the historical figure is kind of shadowy. The historical evidence supporting his when he reigned and how much territory in Norway he really controlled, it's pretty thin. But in the Egil saga, he lives. He is a major figure. And the rivalry and hatred that develops between Egil, our main character, and then Eric Bloodaxe is what ultimately leads Egil to go and fight for Eric's enemies. And he becomes entangled in the wars that are taking place in the British Isles, and particularly in England, between the Anglo-Saxon kings and the Viking invaders, which again is part of, you know, one of the interesting things about the sagas, which is the way in which they reflect what the real action, the real events. They're not records of historical records, but they give us, if you like, a kind of cultural echo of what has happened and what people are doing and what they're thinking through it all. There's one other aspect of Egil that we mustn't forget, though, John, and that is the fact that besides being a ferocious, bloodthirsty warrior, he's also a great poet. He's on the battlefield. He can't help himself. He has to compose verses describing, you know, his exploits and talking about his joy at, you know, slaying his enemies and at vanquishing his foes. So we have these two sides of this person, you know, who is this incredibly brutal warrior on the one side, but at the same time has the artistic gifts of a poet, and for whom that part of himself, the artistic aesthetic side, is just as important, and it's just as much a part of his moving through the world as it is, you know, his exploits with sword and broadaxe.
You're listening to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review, and I want to tell you about National Review Plus. With NR Plus, you get unlimited access to National Review's digital magazine. That means no paywall, all the issues in our online archive, and all the podcasts. But this is more than a digital subscription. It's a membership that includes access to our members-only Facebook page, members-only conference calls with NR writers, editors, and guests, members-only commenting on the site, and a lot fewer ads, including none within articles. To learn more, please go to nationalreview.com/PLUS. Arthur, the Vikings are famous for exploration, maybe even globalization.
Yes.
You might say they were the first among the first inhabitants of Iceland, and then they moved on to Greenland, and then they moved on even to North America before Columbus. What do the sagas tell us about this movement, especially to Greenland and Vinland in North America?
Well, the sagas are actually one of our main sources for those voyages. And for a long time, really the only extant evidence that we have of the idea that Vikings had at some point in the 900s or early 11th century had made it across to North America and had created a settlement there, which they called Vinland after the grapevines that they were found there and cultivated during their tenure in North America. And the two sagas in particular that are important for this are the saga of Eric the Red. Eric the Red is the Viking hero who sailed from Iceland to establish settlements in Greenland, which became a considerable Viking colony, as a matter of fact, about 2,500 to 5,000 inhabitants at one point. And then Eric the Red's son, Leif Erikson, who then sets out to go further west to look for more trade and goods opportunities, just to find out what's there, and who eventually makes it to unspecified spots on the North American coast. The geographic descriptions are not precise. They don't give us any kind of real clues as to exactly where they landed. And for a long period of time, the description of Viking exploration and settlements and families living there, both in the saga of Eric the Red and then the other one, the saga of the Greenlanders, the other main source for discussion about the Vinland settlement, was just assumed to be maybe this is just another set of, epic tales, right? Shrouded in myth and legend about which there may or may not be some historical reality. And it wasn't until the 1960s when a pair of Norwegian archaeologists were working along and excavating along the coast of Newfoundland and actually found the remains of a Viking settlement there at the site of Lance au Meadow, which is French for the Meadow Cove. Sounds like a wine, doesn't it, from the California coast, Meadow Cove. And it's there that they found the remains of some kind of Viking settlement anyway, probably more of a wintering base. In other words, when Viking ships would come to do trade or to cut timber to take back to Greenland and had to stay over on the winter, they could do that and then head back home to Greenland and then to Iceland in the spring. Definitely solid evidence, clear evidence, that the stories from the Viking sagas about exploration of North American settlements there were true, and not just a poet's imagination or fiction.
At the top of our show, you name dropped J.R.R. Tolkien and Wagner. You even mentioned Star Wars. What's the connection between the Viking sagas and these productions of high culture, mass culture, pop culture?
Geek culture, as I call it.
Exactly.
Yeah, the connection is direct, and it really flows again through the Viking saga literature. And it flows through two sources in particular. One is the two bodies of sagas describing the cosmology and the fate of the gods, the Norse pagan gods, that comes in two forms. One in what's known as the poetic Edda, and the other one the prose Edda. That talk about all the gods that we think about when we think about the Norse gods, Wotan and Thor and Loki and Freya and the great struggle at the end of the world, the great apocalyptic conflict at Ragnarok, when the gods have to confront the giants and the trolls for control and destiny of the cosmos. So that's a rich and very vivid collection of stories and of characters and really a whole sort of metaphysics underlying Norse mythology and these gods and goddesses in the world which they rule and in which human beings are their subordinates. The other one is the Volsung saga. This is the story of a Viking hero named Sigurd and of his journey and exploits as he pursues the quest for the ring that will give him ultimate power and will make him and the possessor of the ring have extraordinary powers over other human beings and over the world. And of course, it's that image of the right, pursuit of the ring that underlies the whole story behind the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And that pursuit of absolute power over not only the world of human beings, but really over the cosmos, becomes part of the pursuit that we see reflected in the Star Wars stories as well. Those two saga works, the Volsung saga, the story of the Volsung family and Sigurd, their main hero, and the prose and poetic Eddas, became the source for two great masterworks of European literature, and I would say European music and drama. Richard Wagner's The Ring of the Nibelungen operas, on the one hand, and then on the other, J.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and the stories of Middle-earth, which is an image taken straight out of Norse mythology.
And let's not forget some pretty good Led Zeppelin lyrics as well.
That's right, the Immigrant Song. You know, it would have been interesting when I wrote Viking Heart, I thought about using a quotation from Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song, right? Do you know how much it costs to try and excerpt even a stanza from that song? It's an enormous sum of money, so I had to give it a pass. Well,
Arthur, let me ask a question for our listeners who may want to try to read a Viking saga. Is there one you'd recommend, or maybe an edition of several sagas that you prefer?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I would say one of the places you could really start if you really want to get the flavor of understanding their influence is I would start with the Saga of the Volsungs, the story of Sigurd and his conflicts with his bride-to-be Brunhild. I mean, these are familiar names for those who are Wagner fans. I think that's a really good place to start. There are some sagas are long and some are short, and there's a number of shorter sagas that you could turn to. But most of those tend to be in large collections of sagas. I think the Volsung sagas is a great place to start because it's short, the story moves quickly, and it'll have a familiar ring because you say, I think I've run across these characters before in a Wagner opera maybe, or when I was reading or watching Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. The other one you should definitely pick up is for its historical content and its links to our own country is the Vinland Sagas. There's a Penguin Classics edition of both the Saga of the Greenlanders and the Saga of Eric the Red. And then I think of the longer ones, the more sort of, should we say, novelistic ones, I think Egil's Saga is a great place to start because the action moves fast, the characters are very well drawn, and even Egil himself, although at first you're like, this guy's impossible, he's like this ferocious, bloodthirsty warrior, you know, who at one point even tears out the throat of an enemy with his teeth in the course of the fighting. But you watch him as he grows and develops as a character and becomes more, at peace with himself and peace with others as the saga goes on. There's something incredibly moving about that process. And then I think Njal's saga, when you're ready to read something that is really, should we say, for a more mature, I'd even say sophisticated audience, I think Njal's saga is the next step. I think it's generally recognized as being the greatest of all the Norse sagas, and it's definitely worth a read. As I say, when I talk about these as great works of literature, you've got to understand, I was trained as a medievalist. I read Beowulf in the original Old English. I read the German epics. You know, I struggled with learning Middle High German so I could, you know, plunge into Parsifal and Tristan. Old French, John, I would have dreams in Old French when I was reading Song of Roland. And these are all very impressive pieces of medieval literature, but they don't speak to us anymore. You read them, you look at them, they are of a time and a place very remote from us. The Norse sagas, I think, have a universal human quality in the characters and the actions, the conflicts and the dilemmas that they face that makes them, I think, timeless. And that's one reason why, great artists like Tolkien and like Richard Wagner and also George Lucas could seize on the themes and even some of the characters from these sagas and bring them to life in a modern setting and even in the setting of Thor movies. Here there is something that resonates even with modern audiences reaching back more than 2,000 years.
Let's wrap up with a final question about your new book, which is called The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. There's a lot in that book about the sagas, but it's about a lot more than just the sagas, too. Arthur, what is the Viking heart?
What I try to describe in that book is the cultural skill set that developed during the Viking Age of these Scandinavian tribes struggling in this incredibly inhospitable environment with such few resources in which to make a life for yourself and your family, and of the cultural skill set that develops in that environment, which then carries over into the way in which Scandinavians live in the post-Viking age, including in Iceland. And I have a long chapter there on the Viking settlement in Iceland and the way in which Iceland became this important outpost for Norse civilization and culture well into the Middle Ages, including, of course, the Norse sagas. But also then carried on to become part of the modern Scandinavian character as it was Christianized, as it became part of the Lutheran Reformation, which changed and gave a more human and more compassionate face to what it was, to that kind of strong sense of enterprise and daring that the original Vikings had brought as part of their pagan inheritance. And then the second half of the book is really about how that Viking heart, that cultural skill set, made it to America in the 19th century and became part of the warp and woof of American culture through the Scandinavian-American experience and those who came over. It is, John, I would say to readers, the most personal of my books, of all my 10 books that I've written, because it is, you know, partly about my family and about my mother's parents, who both of whom came over from Norway just before World War I, and also my father's side, whose great-grandfather, you know, fought in a Norwegian-led regiment, the 15th Wisconsin, during the Civil War. But it's also one that I think, as you'll see, if you've got an interest in the Viking sagas, and listening to us talk about them, The Viking Heart is a good book for helping to set that into a context of understanding the time and the place and the mindset of those who wrote them, of those who read them, and also why it is, again, they carry on and live on in our own age.
Arthur Herman, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the Viking sagas.
Tardy, my pleasure.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @haymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.